Milwaukee Journal Sentinel Milwaukee Bucks podcast, Trade Deadline Edition, joins you on a Tuesday morning. The Milwaukee Bucks are a couple days away from the 2020 NBA trade deadline. They got a game tonight against Zion Williamson and the New Orleans Pelicans. They're back on Thursday against the 76ers. It is, you know, still, as it has been all year, a fun time to be a Milwaukee Bucks fan. A lot of intrigue ahead. My name is J.R. Radcliffe, host of the podcast. On the other line is Matt Velasquez, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel beat reporter covering the Milwaukee Bucks. Matt, how are you? Have the Denver Nuggets stopped making three-pointers against the Milwaukee Bucks? Can you confirm?
I can confirm. Will Barton, Malik Beasley, Nikola Jokic sightings in the past, 72 hours? Definitely haven't seen those guys. We'll get a chance to see him again in March, but as of right now, it has stopped raining threes.
That's good to know. The Bucks, of course, as many fans know, did take a loss since we last checked in. They've had a couple games. They bounced back on Sunday, Super Bowl Sunday, with a win over those pesky Phoenix Suns, who beat the Bucks twice last year, despite only racking up 19 wins total. Suns are better this year. They've already got 20 wins this year, but not against Milwaukee, as Milwaukee won that one going away. We've seen some typical performances over the last couple games from Giannis, who nearly had a 30-20-10 triple-double, just missed doing that against the Suns. Chris Middleton has been his efficient self. It's been sort of business as usual, even with the loss. I do want to talk a lot about the trade deadline and focus on that first and foremost, but real quickly, checking in on that loss to Denver, the times the Bucks have lost, and really since the turn of the calendar to 2020, it's been because teams are shooting three-pointers at a ridiculous rate, making three-pointers at a ridiculous rate. Even last year, we saw this team give up a couple performances. I want to say the Mavericks had one where they made as many three-pointers as they had made in club history at one point. I get the feeling that the Bucks don't care about that. They care. They don't want to lose games. They do want to defend the 3-point shot. But if you're going to shoot that well, congratulations, tip your cap. You're going to beat the Bucks. The Bucks are not going to alter their defensive shape to combat that. And it seems like this year's Bucks team is just so good defensively all around. They know what they have to surrender, and if you're making those shots, good on you. I think that's what we're going to see, that if a team could shoot like that, the Bucks aren't necessarily going to have an answer. I just don't know, Matt, if most teams are going to really be able to shoot like that, especially in a seven-game series when we get to the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, they know who they are. They know who they want to be. Come playoff time, I think we've talked about this before, like, they could very well switch their defense up and start switching more and playing more of that that style that we see a lot more teams play. They did it a bunch last year during the Raptors series, for example. Maybe they didn't do it enough. But at the same time, like, they still did it. There was a willingness to change. Mike Budenholzer wasn't inflexible. They did it some against the Celtics, too, after losing game one. This is just basically them doing what they do in the regular season, getting really good at it, building their habits, and they do have the best defense in the league, so there is something to be said for that. You look at, obviously, the Denver game. The Nuggets go 22 of 46 on threes, 47.8%, just bananas. Like, they're basically 50% all the way up until, like, late in the game when they missed a couple in garbage time. But then on Sunday, the Suns only shot 23 threes, the fewest a team has shot against the Bucks all year, making six. And that game obviously went very differently. And part of that is just that Phoenix was undermanned and wasn't taking as many threes. But the Bucks were also doing a good job of staying attached to shooters, not letting Devin Booker in particular get open. They picked up a lot of fouls, fighting over screens and trying to deal with him on the perimeter. Kind of indicative of the way they were trying to be aggressive and stick with him. They're 42-7. Like, teams know exactly the defense the Bucks are going to play. They played it all last year. They're playing it all this year. And even, that being the case, even though they're taking a lot of threes, I think you take that winning percentage 10 times out of 10. That's just my guess. And then there are going to be outlier shooting games, just like the Bucks are going to have outlier shooting games. I mean, when they beat the Celtics earlier this year at Pfizer Forum, the Bucks shot 51.6% on threes. They can do it too. When they scored 151 points on the Wizards, they made 19 of 37 threes. That's 51.4% on threes. The last time they played the Pelicans, who they'll be playing Tuesday night, basically 49% on threes. Like, they can do it too. They have those outlier games too. They're almost an equal proportion to the number of games that the opposing teams have shot over 40% on threes 17 times. Bucks have done it 12 times, but they've been at 39 plus, a bunch more times after that. So you're looking at kind of very similar 3-point shooting numbers when you look at the top end. There are those outlier games that everybody has, and it's just so happened that that's the only way the Bucks have lost in the past month and maybe month and a half or 6 weeks or whatever it was since Christmas. The Nuggets game, the Spurs game, the Sixers game, and other than that, Utah in that close game out west, they had a pretty decent shooting night from three. Dallas did too. Boston had I think the most they've had in a half. When they beat the Bucks in Boston, Dallas did a million things well in the game they won at Fiserv Forum, but 3-point shooting was one of them. The only game that the Bucks, that they lost and they didn't necessarily give up a ton of 3-point shooting was their first loss of the year against the Heat in overtime. But that's it. I think the long story short is the defense works, except where sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, I saw some tweets about fans concerned that, well, this could happen against a good team in the playoffs, that they shoot well from three. And someone pointed out that the Raptors, obviously we remember Fred VanVleet a little bit, but in that series, they shot fine from 3-point range, but they didn't shoot into this outlier range. And if you believe this team, and certainly the evidence points this way, is now so good defensively that they are only going to lose if somebody shoots an outlier percentage from 3-point range, then, look back and see. They probably win one or two of those games that they lost against the Raptors this time around. So it is encouraging that actually to me that when they lose these games, it requires superhuman effort, something you're just not going to see every night. And not only that, but six of their seven losses have come against just top crust teams, top six teams in the East or top seven in the West. Like the majority of the teams that are beating them are exceptional teams and shooting as well as they have all year. That is a very good sign for the Bucks.
Well, and you mentioned the Raptors last year. The only two games in which the Raptors shot like exceedingly well, over 40%, were games, five and six. And, shooting like 42%, 44% in those games from 3-point range. But at the same time, as you might recall, those games were incredibly close. They ended up being 6-point Bucks losses. And that's just a function of, if maybe the Raptors don't shoot as well. Or miss one or two threes that they made, or the Bucks, in game five, they were 10 of 31, 32.3%. If they make, one or two more, get a little bit closer to having an average shooting night, they probably win. And you look at that series, the fact that the Bucks were as close as they were in all those games, despite shooting, let's see, I gotta add it all up really quickly here, 31% on threes, that's awful. That's like the worst team in the league, like over the course of a season type numbers. You can look at the defense and say, oh, the Bucks didn't do well enough to slow the Raptors down, or Fred VanVleet got hot, or Kawhi was doing crazy Kawhi stuff from the mid range. You can say all that, and that's all very well true. But if the Bucks shoot their season average from 3-point range, if they're closer to 35%, they probably win two of those games. As much as you might want to say that their defense wasn't good enough, I think that, there's an argument to be made that in some ways it was, and that their offense, really was what let them down in that series. And so we'll have to see, what happens come playoff time this year, regardless of who they match up against, if they can sustain, the level of defense that they played or the kind of defense that they've played. We'll see if that allowance of 3-pointers is something that continues. But at the same time, like if they can sustain their offensive numbers, which I think they're number two in the league in offense and number one in the Eastern Conference, if they can sustain that, I mean, they'll be just fine, or at least numbers indicate they'll be just fine against almost any other opponent. So we'll have to see. How that bears out in the coming months.
If we're talking about moments at Fiserv Forum this year in terms of fan volume, I know it ended up being a loss, but with Thanasis starting the game against the Nuggets on Greek Night and Giannis throwing a bounce pass to Thanasis for a layup. I think that was some hoop and harm. It sounds like the place just went up for grabs at that point. What was it like being inside the venue at that point?
That was pretty loud. People enjoyed it. People were getting some good energy off of Thanasis and you know his early steal for a dunk, and then you know Giannis hitting him with that pass for the and one. Giannis loved it. He was going nuts. I was thoroughly confused because you know we I phrased this in my question to Bud after the game, but we don't ask him pregame about his starting lineup. Like we got into a habit. You know the great Charles Gardner who had this job before me. He used to ask Jason Kidd, you know, oh, same starters. Like every pregame press conference, he'd make sure because sometimes Jason Kidd would change him, you know, and that he'd shake things up. And, you know, that's more likely to happen when you have a team around 500. You're kind of tinkering and moving things around and riding hot hands and things like that. Bud doesn't do that. Like Bud hasn't done that the whole time, really, that he's been the coach. He has a starting unit that he likes, and barring injury, which we ask about injuries, that's par for the course. But barring any injuries, he's sticking with the five guys who he normally has out there. So nobody asked pregame, hey, Bud, like, you going to take a guy who has only played 56 minutes this year and put him in the starting lineup? Because, like, why? Like, why would we expect that? Like, you know, I don't know, they haven't had a Greek night since Thanasis has been on the team, you know, but they've had other theme nights or games against former teams or special event, whatever you want to, you know, call it. And then Bud has not changed. So, you know, this was very new. It was unexpected, unannounced. Thanasis had not played in the first, second, or third quarter of any game this season. Like I said, he'd only played 56 minutes, all kind of in mop-up duty, you know, taking care of games that either the Bucks were out of or more often were blowing teams out. And so, you know, I think that it was weird. It was different. It was a dream come true for Giannis and Thanasis to be able to start together in an NBA game, and at the end of the day, I think there was, you know, no harm done. The Bucks were up 16-4 when Thanasis subbed out, and it wasn't like Brook Lopez, who was displaced, was brooding on the bench or anything like that. Like you could see him when Thanasis had the steal for a dunk, he's on the bench like jumping up and down, you know, like this is like the greatest thing in the world. So, obviously the game didn't turn out the way the Bucks would like with that loss to Denver. But I don't think you can necessarily blame it on starting Thanasis or mixing things up or messing with chemistry. I think that the three pointers and everything else that we already talked about had a lot to do with that. But it was definitely an interesting and new and I'll say strange situation, that's for sure.
Speaking of chemistry, we're going to get to the trade deadline stuff here real quick. But one quick thing that struck me from the Phoenix Suns game, Giannis just seems like, I mean, he's putting up great numbers. He is just getting hammered over and over his drives to the basket. And we've talked about this. It's not new, but it still feels like to me that he's not getting a lot of calls. And you could see the frustration from Mike Budenholzer on the sideline. You could see the frustration from Giannis. At one point, he threw his hands up, wondering where the whistle was, and the whistle had actually came. It came. Like he got the and one. He just is so used to being upset that he's not getting the foul call. Is this just in our heads because Giannis is so frequently moving toward the basket that the amount of whistles he gets really is proportional to what he should be getting? Or are you noticing still that there is some frustration and it's still very difficult to officiate this guy, and he maybe isn't getting the contact that another player would get, the whistles that another player would get.
I mean, it is hard to officiate him, that's for sure. And part of that is because he is so physically strong that he can look like he is undeterred, you know, that his motion or his movement wasn't impeded, because he can power through things the way some other players can't. And it's funny, you know, as kind of a side gig, I appear on the post game show on 105.7 FM The Fan after Bucks games. And you know, so I talked to Bill Schmidt on those game on those you know shows, and we talk, you know, for about 10 minutes or so. And he and I were talking on Sunday. I guess Kyle Korver was on one of their shows on Thursday night. I think the Bucks basketball hour, whatever they have on Thursday nights. And Korver was talking about how he's been trying to talk to Giannis and telling him, hey, like, everything you're doing is great. Like, all these things are good. Like, you are the MVP, you know everything. But at the same time, if while you're driving, like, and you maybe just throw your head a little bit, or you kind of, you know, move, like, your off arm a little bit, like, you maybe exaggerate the contact or make it more apparent for the refs, maybe you'll get more calls. And you can kind of, you know, if you can sell the foul, you know the foul's happening. You can feel the foul happening. But if you sell the foul more, like, you'll get more calls. And Giannis is like, I'm not doing that. Like, he's like, that's just not what I do. Like, I'm not going to be dramatic or act or – and I don't know the full extent of the answer that he gave in terms of the actual words he said. But the gist of what he said was, I'm not doing that. That's not me. Like, I'm not about that. And so, I mean, it's not like other players don't notice or his teammates don't notice or trying to come up with ideas of ways for him to get more foul calls. It's just that he is kind of stubborn in that, you know, he wants to play a certain way and he doesn't want to show weakness and he doesn't want to show be like other guys. He doesn't want to be like players, you know, maybe James Harden, maybe other guys who are trying to kind of flail a little bit more in order to sell the foul. And maybe that's to his detriment. Maybe that's the level of gamesmanship maybe that he needs to maybe adjust to or evolve to or whatever you want to, how you want to call it. Maybe he needs to get there so that he can get more trips to the line. But it also says something about him that he just doesn't want a part of that. He wants to be able to, you know, do what he always does, you know, project that strength, you know, go to the rim, not try to worry his mind with trying to, like, you know, oh, like, I got hit on the arm. Let me, like, move my head to the left. Like, he just wants to, like, go out there, you know, power through, make sure he gets the layup instead of, like, you know, kind of flopping around and not getting it. And he just wants the refs to do a better job. I mean, I'm he's not saying that. I think that I'm projecting that's what he would think. But it's just interesting to kind of get into his psyche. Because he has been dealing with this for a long time. This isn't new, like you said. Like, he gets fouled. Like, he creates contact. He invites contact. It's just part of how he plays. And, you know, with that are going to come instances where he's just not going to get calls. And, you know, that, I guess if you're not going to try to sell the fouls more, you got to take what you get.
I had some names that I wanted to ask you about. Moving in here to the trade deadline stuff, there's a lot of names that are getting thrown around in general in the NBA, and certainly some that fit with what the Bucks would potentially need if you're looking to upgrade anything at all from a team that's 42-7 and flying toward the top seed in the East. But you met up with John Horst, Bucks general manager, and posted something at jsonline.com that I think kind of throws a wet blanket on the idea of trades at all. Tell me what your conversation was like and why you think the Bucks are headed toward, you know, maybe a fairly inactive February 6th trade deadline.
Yeah, so I talked with John Horst a little bit recently, and, you know, I kind of just started out by saying, all right, your best team in the NBA had to get better. He was like, oh, man, like softball, huh? But the gist of it was that they already think that they're getting better, right? Like, they think that they grew off of last year, that they got better over the summer, that they made the free agent acquisitions that they needed to make, and that they've been able to create this juggernaut of a regular season team, at least, where, you know, they have a historic point differential. They have the reigning MVP. They have the reigning coach of the year. They have the best record in the league. And so they're trusting those numbers and they believe in those numbers and they believe in the chemistry that they've built. You know, and at the same time, like, they're still trying to do something, right? In the sense that, like, they're not just sitting on their hands or putting their heads in the sand. Like, they recognize how irresponsible that would be to do nothing or to at least not be receptive to anything or do their due diligence, do their homework. But at the same time, like, they're going to be, Horst's words were, incredibly patient and specific and intentional if they are going to do something. And he followed that up by saying, more than likely not. Like, it's more than likely that they're not going to do something, you know, because they really like the group they have and they want to, you know, stay focused on that group. They want to trust the chemistry and the continuity and the development. And they want to kind of just continue building the way they've been building. And, you know, so I asked him a little bit more about that. I was like, hey, man, like, the chemistry, like, how important is it? Like, obviously you have it. Like, is there any feeling that you don't want to, like, mess it up? And he was like, oh, yeah, that's paramount. Like, that's, you know, the fabric of our team, you know, the makeup of the individuals and how they fit as a group, like however you want to define that, if you want to call it chemistry or culture or whatever, like that's a huge thing for them. Like that they want to make sure that, you know, now that they have it, they want to protect that, you know, as they continue to move forward, because every team in the NBA, they're searching for chemistry and a good culture and a group that fits together and works together both on the court and off. And so, you know, the Bucks, you know, it's apparent that they have that. And so no matter what move you make, whether it be a big one or something more on the fringes, like it's going to impact the team and the locker room and everything. So, you know, you definitely don't want to mess that up.
Some of the names I was going to throw your way, and we won't talk about them individually necessarily. Guys like Robert Covington has been floated about, although I think the Timberwolves are talking about wanting 2 first-round picks for him, which, you know, the Bucks aren't going to improve at the cost of completely destroying their future. They're already, you know, they already don't have all that many draft picks in the immediate future. Davis Bertans, a guy that they saw firsthand, who had a nice shooting performance from the Wizards, feels like that could be kind of a Nikola Mirotic type upgrade if they wanted to go that route. Jay Crowder is fun because he went to Marquette, not because he might be the best fit, but I was curious about him. And the big one,
Marquette Hall of Famer, Jay
Marquette,
Crowder.
that's right, Marquette
Did
Hall
he?
of Famer.
There you go.
And the other one, I think, is the one that a lot of people have circled. That's Bogdan Bogdanovic, who kind of fits the need, you know, a shooting guard, maybe a guy who can spread the floor a little bit more, who's got, you know, marksmanship. That seems to be a guy that a lot of teams are interested in, and certainly I think the Bucks would be under normal circumstances. But, you know, I guess what you're saying is it's not going to be worth the cost. Those are guys that a lot of teams are interested in, and it's probably a situation where it's going to cost them that first round pick for sure. Possibly Dante DiVincenzo, certainly Ersan on an expiring contract, maybe another piece as well. Sounds like that's just not something the Bucks are going to be into. Even though those guys could potentially add something for this playoff ahead, which is kind of the focal point now for the Bucks.
Yeah, and I talked to Horst too about the deal last year for Nikola Mirotic, because that's the kind of thing that I've always thought, like, okay, if they're going to make a deal, it'd probably be something like that, right? Like where they took Thonmaker, who wasn't playing at that point really at all for them, and Jason Smith, who definitely wasn't playing at all, along with 4 second-round picks, a bunch of which they had collected over the course of the season through kind of fringe moves and like adding, you know, taking Jody Meeks off the hands of the Wizards to help them clear cap and using their you know, exception to do that, but also taking a pick back from the Wizards in another deal. I think they already had a pick from the Nuggets, and so they had all these picks, and they were able to take those with two players who they weren't using and send Thon to the Pistons, get Stanley Johnson back because Stanley Johnson was more valuable to the Pelicans than Thon was, and then take Stanley Johnson and Jason Smith to match the salaries to get Nikola Mirotic while also sending those 4 second-round picks. Like that's a deal that, you know, you're taking guys who aren't playing and a few assets that you have that maybe aren't super useful. Like I don't know that the Bucks had or have a use for that many second round picks, especially with the way their team is constituted right now. And you turn them into a player who can jump right into your rotation and immediately raise the ceiling of your team, whether or not that actually happens. And as we saw, it didn't work out all that great. The process was good. And the deal at the time, I don't think there was anyone who would have argued that it wasn't a good deal, or at least positive or potentially positive for the Bucks. And so I asked him about that, and I was like, well, is that the kind of thing we could expect? Like, if you do anything? And he was like, well, I guess, you know, and the reasons were good, and the deal last year made a lot of sense. He's like, but those are hard to generate. Like, those deals are hard to do. And like, you know, it took getting the picks and getting Stanley Johnson and having the right salaries and making it all match up, like, and it came out perfect. But, you know, to be able to find a deal like that this year, to be able to take guys who aren't playing and be able to convert them and other assets into another player, it's really difficult. And so, you know, they'll look and they'll consider and they'll try and find something if there is something to be found, and they'll be open to you know, other teams calling if there is the possibility of something like that, where they can find a deal that they believe converts maybe some of their fringe guys to a rotational player that makes them better, you know, basketball wise, culture, all that stuff. But otherwise, like, you know, since it's such a hard thing to do, a hard thing to pull off, like, there's a pretty a decent chance that that's not going to happen because it's so rare and difficult to do.
What about the March buyout season? The Bucks added Pau Gasol through this, through that method last year, and that didn't work out because of injuries. Gasol wasn't really much of a contributor, but you know, if there were guys interested in ring chasing last year with the Bucks, and there were, then there's going to be really guys who are interested in ring chasing this year, seeing as the Bucks are at this point the favorite to win the East and maybe the NBA title. I mean, I would assume they could have their pick of the litter if they wanted to add somebody through the, you know, at that point of the season where a lot of big time contracts are getting bought out. Is that off the table too? Because that would potentially impact chemistry in some way, or do you think that's the best mechanism by which they can improve this team at this point?
I don't think that buyouts are necessarily off the market. Sorry, I was distracted for a second. We're recording this on Monday. Pat Connaughton's going to be in the dunk contest.
What? No way! Breaking news on the pod, even though this will pop up a day later.
Yeah, no, Shams Charania from The Athletic just tweeted that out, and so I was distracted. But I don't think that they would be unreceptive to the buyout market. But at the same time, like, they do have a full roster, and they would have to let somebody go. And so the question is, who do you let go? And also who do you get, right? Like, you know, if you have someone on the buyout market who you think could really upgrade your team, you know, it depends on what position they play. Like, they have DJ Wilson under contract for another year, so they'd have to eat like $4 million or whatever he's making next year to let him go. That's probably not going to happen. Sterling Brown is in the last year of his contract and making a relatively small amount. I think probably at the minimum, near the minimum. But they have his bird rights as a restricted free agent this summer. So do you want to cut him and move on? I don't know. He's a useful guy in the playoffs. So who are you going to be getting? Who is going to be better in that position? That's tough to think about. I think that it'd be a very bad idea to cut Thanasis. Even though he doesn't play very often, cutting Giannis' brother right before you can sign Giannis to a Supermax sounds like a bad idea. And then they have Dragan Bender on a really good minimum non-guaranteed contract for next year. He's a former number four pick in the draft. Obviously, he hasn't played a lot this year, but I think they have high hopes for him and what he can be in terms of his value. So I think that moving on from him in a Christian Wood type situation, like last year they cut Christian Wood, who was on exactly the same contract, to get Pau Gasol. They got Pau Gasol first, and then they cut Christian Wood because they had a whole bunch of injuries and they needed another guard. And so they brought in Tim Frazier because they had Bledsoe hurt and they had Brogdon hurt and they had DiVincenzo hurt, and like everyone was hurt. So they needed that. But, you know, Christian Wood's been doing really well for the Pistons this year. Not like great, but like he's finally cracked an NBA rotation. He's actually made, you know, pretty good use out of that time. But I think that they'd really have to find somebody who they thought was like a total ceiling raiser in order to be able to move on from someone. Especially since, like, if you were to cut, you know, Dragan Bender, for example, you know, if you're not bringing back in another big, suddenly you're a Lopez injury away, whether it's Brook or Robin, from being down to just one center. So I think that it really would just depend on who is on the buyout market and how interested they are in coming to Milwaukee. But I would put that as being something that's relatively unlikely too.
Let's quick go back to the breaking news of the moment, breaking in major quotation marks, Pat Connaughton in the dunk contest. Handicap for me, your thoughts on whether or not he can pull that out. We've seen him with some pretty impressive, he's got great ups. We've seen that last year and a half. What do you think? You think he's got a shot in Chicago to bring home the crown?
It'll be tough. I'm not sure exactly how that'll go. And looking at the rest of the field, you have Aaron Gordon, who has already like put on an absolute show at the dunk contest. You have Dwight Howard, who I guess he's put on shows before. I have no idea what he has left. But whatever. Like he'll be there. And Derrick Jones Jr., I think he can actually fly.
These are some like
So
premier flight dunkers. Like you don't get
yeah.
better than this lineup here.
And there's absolutely no doubt in my mind. Like Pat has an incredible vertical. He has thrown down some really great in-game dunks, especially put-back dunks. I've joked before that the best way for him to win the dunk contest would be to like train somebody, maybe get one of his buddies from Notre Dame, like train them on how to miss shots like really well, a la like kind of like the South Park kids playing baseball. Like you train some guy or have somebody train to miss shots so that they can miss those shots. And he can put them back for dunks, and
Yes.
like you can get like great timing because his putback dunks are spectacular. But I don't know what he's going to do in terms of his regular dunks, like on All Star Saturday. But it looks like I'll be at All Star Saturday now, and I'll have something to do because it's in Chicago. I have credentials. I'm ready to go. But if none of the Bucks were going to be doing the dunk contest or the skills competition or the 3-point, like, I was gonna stay home, spend a little extra time with the wife and kids. But now that Pat's at the dunk contest, I very much have a reason to go, and I'm quite interested in the outcome there at the United Center. And so, they hashtag let Pat dunk, so now we'll have to hashtag see Pat dunk.
The Velasquez family, not a huge fan, I imagine, of Pat Connaughton being in the dunk competition, but so it goes. At least you won't have to be there Friday for the skills competition because Dante DiVincenzo was not selected as one of the quote-unquote rising stars of the not the skills challenge, but the rising stars game that usually features first-year and second-year players in the NBA. Tyler Hero of a Milwaukee native who of course plays for the Miami Heat. He's among the guys that will be competing. I had kind of a morbid thought as it relates a little bit to DiVincenzo, because as we talk about trades and trade deadline, I think Dante would be an attractive piece for a team to get back in a deal if a team isn't looking for just a draft pick or an expiring contract or whatever. And it dawned on me that if Giannis does not sign the Supermax deal, if the Bucks begin to find themselves preparing for life after Giannis, which again, morbid thought, don't think that's where we're headed, but in the event that we are, I don't know if Dante is quite good enough where you can say that's a guy they would be building around. But given how veteran this roster is, they don't have a lot of young players. Maybe he's got to be a guy that they have to plan on for 20, what would that be, 2022 and beyond, in case they have to restructure this roster a little bit. Now, maybe it's a situation where the Bucks, if they lose Giannis, they're just going to have to tear this whole thing down, start over, and it doesn't matter who's here now because they're 5 years away from their next, competing team. I don't know. What do you think about that? Do you think that given the slight uncertainty over what Giannis does next, they have to be even more cautious with Dante, or is that just there's just too many other pieces that would be in play?
I don't think they need to be cautious. I mean, that's almost like talking about like, well, the Chiefs don't have Patrick Mahomes after a couple of years from now. It's like, like whatever.
And they may
Like,
not. They may not, but they do have a title, so who cares? Yes.
it's like, let's just get there when we get there. Dante has been really good this season. His shooting has, he's had hot stretches, he's had cold stretches. But overall, offensively, he's brought a good dynamic to the team. Obviously, having him back for Sunday's game when he didn't play on Friday brought some stability and some pop to that second unit. His defense and his ability to get deflections and steals and block alley-oops and save balls from going out of bounds and just all the nonsense and crazy stuff that he does. It's just winning plays and, stuff that you really can't teach. He just has like a really good basketball IQ and knack for sniffing out the ball and making things difficult for opposing players. I think you just ride that and help him grow. I don't know if you build around him. He's a good like support piece, rotational piece, somebody to put next to like Eric Bledsoe and Chris Middleton if you wanted to put him in the starting lineup in the future. We've already seen him in the starting lineup, usually when one of those two guys was hurt. But he's been really good. And so you kind of just let him keep growing. It is only year two. You have 2 more years of DiVincenzo at the very least. And then you have his, his bird rights, and he is a restricted free agent after 2 more seasons. You just let him keep growing and see how it goes. And you hope that none of his injuries from last year, the heel bursitis, that none of that is ends up being a long-term or recurring thing. And you just kind of, and if you're the Bucks, you kind of just enjoy, hey, we got a pick at number 17 that is panning out really well. That's something that we can start and, you know, play big minutes and rely on. And I think his utility will only grow over time, you know, because of the way he's playing right now.
Yeah, you mentioned the guard shortage last year where they needed to bring in Tim Frazier. Right now, with DiVincenzo hurt for that game against the Nuggets, George Hill, we haven't even mentioned him. He's out for a little while with a hamstring situation. So we'll have to talk more about that later in the week, especially if we have another podcast later in the week. If the Bucks do, in fact, make a trade, we'll, of course, have to go back and look at that. One last thought. Because if the Bucks do stay silent, don't do anything at this trade deadline, you know that there will be some antsiness among Bucks Nation because they are sort of standing pat in the midst of where they will clearly be one of the top teams in the postseason. I'm curious what you think if there's a move another team would make, one of their direct competitors in primarily the Eastern Conference, but I guess a West favorite as well, to bolster what they have. The Toronto Raptors last year, I did not think we'd be talking about the Toronto Raptors again this year the way we apparently are going to have to. They're the number two team in the East. They've won 11 straight games. They're on absolute fire. They've overcome just a ridiculous litany of injuries to be very relevant again in 2019-2020. They added Marc Gasol last year, and that obviously wound up paying huge dividends for them against the Bucks and it, you know, just in the playoffs in general. The Sixers are thought of as a dangerous foe, but they've got some weaknesses. Are there one or two moves that one of these other teams could make that could potentially put them much closer to the Bucks level, if not even, you know, on the same tier as the Bucks? Or do you just think Milwaukee's so far ahead, nothing any of these teams are going to do at the trade deadline is going to vault anybody near where the Milwaukee Bucks are sitting?
Well, I mean, you mentioned the Raptors, and they have been really impressive, playing great, but they also, you know, they haven't necessarily played a lot of tough teams during this stretch. It's kind of like when the Bucks had, you know, their recent 9-game win streak and, you know, even the 18-game win streak they had. Like, there were a lot of games against, like, bad teams.
Yep,
like,
for sure.
Like, you know, if you stack them together in such a way, you know, I think, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So the past six wins for the Raptors have been against sub-500 teams. They beat the 76ers at home, and we know how bad the Sixers are on the road. And then they also beat the Hawks, Timberwolves, Wizards. And, you know, at Thunder, the one that started this win streak was probably, you know, one of their best wins. You know, because Thunder have been really good, have exceeded expectations, and, you know, winning on the road like that is pretty impressive. But, you know, that's not to take necessarily away from the Raptors. They have been crushing it. You can only play the schedule that you're given, and, you know, they have a pretty strong point differential at plus 6.7. You know, Kyle Lowry's been incredible. Pascal Siakam's been great. They've been getting contributions up and down the roster. So maybe they're a team that I wouldn't expect to do a lot because, you know, they have this, like, deep, like, you know, high chemistry team that is just operating at a really high level right now, and you don't necessarily want to mess that up too much. I also don't think that, you know, before the season, people thought, oh, they might, you know, fall into the tank now that Kawhi's gone, and maybe you trade Kyle Lowry, and now's the time to get off his big salary and make a big move. I don't think they're doing that at all. He's an all-star and a deserving one at that. And, you know, they're going to try and keep growing with what they got. Boston, yeah, you wonder if they're going to tinker with, you know, moving anyone. I don't know exactly what the best or scariest move for the Bucks, you know, might necessarily be. They have a really good starting lineup. Maybe you would argue that they haven't been, they need to upgrade at center. But I don't know if that's necessarily true. Daniel Tice, Enes Kanter, have been, really solid for them, you know, better than you would expect. They can go small and play a unit where you have, you know, Kemba, Tatum, Brown, Hayward, and Marcus Smart all playing on the floor together, and Marcus Smart kind of playing against a lot you know, bigger guys and holding his own, and just the amount of shooting and ball handling and all that, it's kind of five out to the max when they have that group on the floor. So you know, they can be interesting. I think the Heat are definitely a team that you can envision doing something. They have a lot of those contracts and kind of the mid range of, like, you know, 8 to 12 million that they can kind of stack together and try and turn into somebody else. Obviously, maybe like a Drew Holiday deal to get him over there and give them a more, you know, polished or experienced Point guard option could work. You know, but Kendrick Nunn has been playing great. Goran Dragic off the bench has been really good for them. You know, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, just because they have so many pieces and could figure into a lot of different trades, what they might do to add to that roster. You know, the Pacers, it's hard to tell. They just got Oladipo back. Maybe he's their midseason acquisition. You know, so it's hard to tell exactly what they'll do. And then the 76ers, they've definitely let down relative to expectations. They're 31-19, 11.5 games back of the Bucks. They're 9-17 on the road, which is ugh. But you know, they haven't seemed to necessarily fit together. So the question is, if you're them, do you try to ride this out and try and continue to grow and build together? And actually have one stable team throughout the whole year? Or do you do it like last year? I mean, last year they had like two significant trades. So they, you know, Brett Brown was saying like we had three teams last year. And they had to continuously try to figure out how to adjust and work together. And by the time that they lost in the second round of the playoffs, it seemed like they had figured it out. Just not enough to get past the Raptors. And obviously Kawhi had his incredible four bounce shot that knocked them out. You know, but this is a big season for the 76ers. I mean, they have pushed all in, you know, multiple times, and if they continue to bang their heads against a wall and if they get knocked out in the second round again, who knows what their future looks like. So they could have another big move up their sleeves, another big swing. I'm not sure who it would be that would make them scarier. Obviously they were a team that when they played as well as they did on Christmas against the Bucks, they absolutely routed Milwaukee. So we'll see what Thursday's game has in store. Obviously, this one at Fiserv Forum, and that could definitely affect things. So yeah, I think that'll be interesting. You know, and kind of getting back to my conversation with John Horst about deals, I asked him. I said, "Hey, you know, if you don't make a deal, I mean, people will speculate like what it means." You know, what kind of signals you're sending. You know, maybe you could argue those aren't positive signals if you don't make a deal. And I think his strongest statement to me was, you know, I'll tell you the signal we're sending, that we have a really good team. We trust our coaching staff, we trust our superstar, we trust his supporting group, and that this group is special. They have the ability to do, you know, more than they did last year. He goes, that's the signal. If we don't do anything, that's the signal. And you know, that's why he feels strongly that they're going to be the same team on Thursday morning as they will Thursday night, you know, with the trade deadline in the middle of the day.
Any way you slice it, Thursday will be a fun day for the Milwaukee Bucks and their fans. Trade deadline, whether or not there is a move to be made, they will be playing later that night at Fiserv Forum against the Philadelphia 76ers, trying to avenge that Christmas Day loss. That'll be a nice little statement if they make no moves and fans are a little antsy about that, and then they crush or at least win against Philly. That would certainly help people move on pretty quickly. Thanks for joining us, Matt Velasquez. We will probably, like I said, if there's a deal, we'll probably have to circle back. Maybe we do a Friday podcast and check in with everything. But other than that, we will chat with you again next week. Thank you for joining us, sir.
All right, always glad to do it. If we have to talk Friday, I am happy to do it because I think that you know, I think the fans would like that. I think the listeners and the readers and all that, I think they're down for it.
Nobody loves anything more than they love an emergency podcast. It is those words are very delightful, especially in the thick of a championship season. Read everything Matt Velasquez has at jsonline.com, including that interview with John Horst. Very interesting stuff. Also, find this podcast on Stitcher, Spotify, Apple Podcasts. Leave us a rating review, all that stuff. Help us reach more people. We really appreciate that. We really appreciate every review you guys can leave for us. You can find either one of us on Twitter. I'm at JRRADCLIFFE. He's at Matt_Velasquez. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. We will catch you again next week.